This episode of AVXL is recorded on May 11th, 2017. Amazon Video's coming to Apple TV. We're kind of obsessed with Sony's A1E OLED. It's like a kickstand, people, for your eyes. And we're going to talk about time phase alignments and the glories. Well, actually, the terror of finding a bloom or a cloud and how you might be able to repair that weird spot on your LCD. All that and so much more coming up on AVXL.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right, I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content. No matter what your budget is, home theater, video playback in your dorm room, a decent set of headphones, the best way to get audio into your ears. We are down with the home entertainment awesomeness. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
And we are sitting in the studio contemplating the impending joy of summer.
Joy?
Yeah, well, you're neck deep in baseball madness.
Indeed, indeed.
If you haven't heard his nickname, it's Robert, well, yes, nothing makes me happier than the Dodgers getting beat by anybody. Herron, no disrespect to our Dodgers fans in the audience. And the other big thing, other than Robert getting to watch the Dodgers occasionally lose, is Amazon Video is coming to the Apple TV. And not in a, oh, you can AirPlay it from your phone kind of way. Actual app on the Apple TV Q3, which means this summer.
About time.
About time.
That is the one hang-up I have about the Google, Amazon, and Apple trifecta of all these great streaming devices is that none of them like to play with each other. And this seems to be a good first step. Get Amazon's streaming content available on a device a lot of people have and use. It seems like a win-win all around. It'll definitely open up more of Amazon's content to the folks who have this hardware. And my app experiences overall with Apple TV's gear have been pretty positive. I hardly ever notice it, and it's nice. And I have one of those old school Apple TV boxes with the, I don't know if they still do that nice little aluminum remote control that's nice and thin, but it's just one of those products that just seems to always work and do it pretty well.
What's interesting is this, I think, was more about money, you know, because people are like, oh, Apple's blocking Amazon. And no doubt, Robert mentioned the trifecta, you know.
The horrible trifecta.
Yeah, Amazon and Apple and Google are all battling. They all want to deliver all your video.
They want to be the source.
And give you all your music. Yeah, they want all of your information and all of your money and all of your time. You know, and part of this was like, you know, this also goes back to Amazon. You know, Jeff Bezos, you know, basically cutting off Apple TV sales from Amazon.com, you know, and
another annoyance.
Well, yeah, and it's also, but it's also, it's not funny, but, you know, the reason there was no Apple TV app was because Amazon hadn't submitted an Apple TV app because they didn't want to deal with what they felt were Apple's onerous terms. So in any case, for whatever strange and wondrous reason, they have resolved that, and I will be able to continue my obsession with, you know, watching American Gods, which is actually on Stars, which I can get through Amazon Prime, which I will now be able to watch on either my Apple TV. Well, I will be able to watch on either my Apple TV or my Roku box.
I think the big take out of the story for me was that it clearly is signaling that there is likely going to be a new Apple TV box really soon that will support things like 4K, 4K. UHD, wide color gamut, high dynamic range, and that is long overdue. So,
if they don't deliver 4K on the next Apple TV, I think everybody's going to point and laugh.
Yeah. Oh, they have to. I just assume. It's like there's no reason not
they
to.
They don't. They're Apple. They took the headphone jack off the iPhone. You could argue that that is a technological advancement.
Yep.
Whether you're talking about, you know, I mean, and there's, it's cool. I'm actually excited. One More's, they're going to have a new set. I'm going to get a set of One More earbuds that has a lightning cable on it, right? The Odyssey sign. And but, headphones come with lightning cable. So there's some cool stuff you can do with a headphone amp and a DSP and a lightning cable, but
still,
you know, Apple gonna Apple.
And one thing too I like about the UHD boxes, and assuming Apple is going to bring one out, a new, you know, ultra high def Apple TV box, is generally they'll have faster CPUs in them too for just general usability. I find even if you didn't have a 4K TV, I would still consider buying a box that supports 4K just because they generally have a little more horsepower in them, and they tend to age better than I find the current gen of either a streaming stick device or something like that. You know, it all kind of comes down to what you're comfortable spending on a device like that. But I find that as soon as I picked up something like the Chromecast Ultra, I tend to ignore all the other Chromecasts I've purchased just in terms of, you know, everything from reboot speed to if it ever needs to be, to just general how quickly it will scale up the performance to max quality, those kind of things. I just find that these new 4K boxes tend to do it a little bit better. So, and I'm looking forward to seeing something similar from Apple. The one thing, and I hate to be the baseball junkie, but I will say that the app itself, the MLB streaming TV app that you can use for watching games, I still don't see another version that surpasses the functionality of what I get from the PlayStation version in terms of being able to select different audio feeds specifically. It is such a neat thing on that platform to be able to go, oh, you know what? I want to listen to the local radio announcers with the international TV broadcast, or I want to hear just the stadium sound and things like that. They need to, I hope the MLB folks will at least help encourage the other platforms to adopt some of those basic features. I keep going back to the PlayStation specifically because it has certain features that the app doesn't seem to offer on other platforms. So anyway, bring it on, Apple. I want it now.
And what Apple and Amazon give, Amazon and HBO will take away. Summer 2018, HBO is going to be yanking or not renewing its library of shows on Amazon, or Amazon Prime, I should say, sometime in the middle of 2018, basically because HBO wants to grow HBO Now.
And understandable.
We've talked about this in the past, is that the downside of Netflix success followed by Amazon Prime success followed, you know, which is, you know, and Apple TV and everything else, is that all of the studios and all of the various, you know, networks all are like, you know, if we can just get $9 a month from everyone, you know, it's worth eliminating all our other revenue sources if we can just make that $9 a month off of
nothing
everybody.
Nothing is like a library. And I don't see that coming anytime soon, where once the content is acquired for a particular service, they keep it for life. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're stuck with this month-to-month or season-to-season change of what's available online. That's kind of annoying, to say the least. And I don't see that changing anytime soon.
No, it's not. I mean, and especially with something like HBO.
It makes me
so
kind of
much.
Long for the days of the VHS tape place where you could go rent the things. Because once you bought that tape, as long as it wasn't destroyed, it would just go back up on the shelf, and they would literally keep it forever. And it's the same thing with books, digitizing books. The problems that have gone into that. So.
I mean, and in a perfect world, in the studio's perfect world, they would eliminate all hard copies, and everything would be watched. You would pay per view, every single view, as you were allowed to watch their heavily encrypted stream on a very select, hardened encrypted devices. But fortunately, we still have Blu-ray and UHD for a while. So, in any case, you got a year to
live it up.
Yeah, I mean, I already pay for HBO Now, so that's not going to really negatively impact me.
Cool.
But I wish they would get Call the Midwife up a little faster on Amazon Prime.
Understood.
My wife is obsessed with that show. The you are excited. Possibly, I feel comfortable saying that the coolest television we saw at CES probably came from Sony. I was fascinated by the big Sony, in part because the thin TVs are just, much like thin phones, are just irritating me more and more.
The desire factor?
The desire factor.
Upgrade?
I have no desire
it's
to have a
3-millimeter
thin
television.
It's the
first time you've seen something so visually stimulating that you just want to lick it.
I will say, I have seen Robert lick technology and doorknobs in Las Vegas.
I don't recommend that.
Robert has a stronger immune system than most people do. But I really liked the whole idea of that kickstand
Oh, yeah.
Not that I would probably ever put my television on the floor because children and dog, but, you know, if you're living a more single, childless lifestyle in your luxurious loft space, man, it's above and beyond the style
points.
It's a sweet design. It is also a fantastic looking television.
Oh, yeah. And the AE, we're talking about the A1E OLED from Sony. That's out now. I'm seeing it popping up in people's homes. List price, $4,000 for that 55-inch version and $5,500 for the 65-inch version. And, yeah, definitely was one of the most impressive TVs we saw there, as are many OLEDs, but Sony's touches, specifically with video processing, that design, their unique audio system in that, all of it is just something I've really come to appreciate. However, recently, I did take a trip down to Sony HQ and checked out, I put some eyeballs on the new 930E, and this will be also part of the 940E as well. That's simply the largest version in this particular series. But in terms of just for LCD performance, excellent black levels, Sony has really jumped ahead. They've actually gone to the vertically aligned panel technology for this year. So they're not using the IPS panels that gave you better off-axis viewing at the expense of some black level performance, specifically your contrast. So with this new 930 that I had a chance to preview, the light output on this thing was so impressive with a good matte finish screen that was anti-reflective. And when you're sitting front and center on it, the black levels were superb. Full array local dimming. I forget how many zones, not many, but enough, some to at least provide that effect of when you're watching things like letterbox content or just a well-contrasted scene, it can offer improved contrast performance compared to TVs that lack that. So if you're looking for premium TVs, yeah, I have to say the Sonys are looking fantastic. Either that A1E OLED or that X930E. As a, let's see, what do they got? $2,000 for the 55-inch list price for the 930E, $3,000 for the 65-inch, and $6,000 for that 75-inch X940. All running at Android TV. I actually do not mind that so much. I find that seems to age a little bit better than most app platforms. And the fantastic image quality, though, even compared to last year's models, like last year's the 930D model compared to the 930E, the light output alone was just eye-grabbing. And you combine that with equal improvements in terms of color performance and just overall just a fantastic set. It lacks some of, I think the 930E actually lacks one feature that they have in the OLED related to minimizing banding artifacts. Mm-hmm. No, it actually does have that feature. What it lacks is a conversion for doing SDR to HDR conversion with as much detail as the OLEDs are going to do. They had to save something for the OLEDs, basically. So they put a little extra special sauce in their top of the line. But without a doubt, just in terms of something more affordable than an OLED, do not poo-poo the LCDs I see coming out of Sony right now. They're as desirable as anything. And I will say it has really nothing to do with picture performance, but on that 930E, the design of it was fantastic too. We talk about design. This is something Sony's doing really well this year. If you walk around on the backside of that 930E, it has just a beautiful textured backside to it that just, it's just a sign that they looked at it from all sides when they were thinking about putting together a fantastic looking TV from the front and the back. And that's enough of that.
We're just saying, you might want to consider it.
Go take a look in the stores. Feast your eyes upon the beautiful pixels, especially if you're rolling some of these new 4K streaming services or the ultra-high-def Blu-ray. These TVs look fantastic. Loving it. And speaking of streaming services, I don't know if this is really important to a lot of people, but Netflix is rolling out their mobile HDR programming for specifically, at least right now, Samsung S8 phones, the new Galaxy S8, and the LG G6 phones. And the good folks up at HDTV Test had an article about that we'll link to in the show notes. I am at least hopeful and thankful to see this will likely bring improved color rendering on mobile devices. So if you have this OLED phone that has a well-calibrated factory preset for an expanded color palette,
right,
similar to what we're dealing with in 4K broadcast now.
I was also going to say, Dell has released a bunch of 1080p monitors that have, Dell HDR, which I consider HDR-ish.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't, you know, it's 99% sRGB, so it's not actually the full color palette of HDR.
It's color as much as anything.
Yeah. And it's also not as bright as we would expect from a television, but as one of the folks at Dell pointed out to me, you know, you're generally 2.5 feet from your monitor. Do you really need 1,000 nits? And I was like, well, probably not.
No.
But a larger color gamut would be nice.
And you think about the challenges. Thinking about something like a studio professional doing color grading or something on a monitor that has to be like, say,
yeah,
do you want to sit in front of a 4,000 nit monitor? And you can't do that in a dark
without
room.
Without sunglasses.
You can't do it in a pitch black room and be effective and comfortable. So you have to we get into bias lighting and other things like that. But
get a Luminoodle.
But yeah, exactly.
USB LED lighting.
I will say though
that to the back of your monitor.
For mobile devices, ever since I had my hands on an OLED screen for my phone, it's very hard for me to go back and look back at LCD screens anymore, especially in darkroom viewing. So I you know what? Yeah, I'm glad to see HDR and hopefully improve color coming to mobile programming, but I don't know. You know what? I'll be curious, though. I guess as a test, just to see if you can output through maybe an MHL cable or something, or whatever your video output is, direct to the TV using your phone as like a, you know, maybe in a hotel room or something. So I'll be curious to see if you're able to output any of that expanded color or high dynamic range detail through one of these devices.
So when you're sitting in the darkness of your hotel room,
coming up with these counting edge use cases,
counting the minutes until you finally pass out before getting up at 6:30, so what's, you can catch
what's
shuttle
more convenient? Holding that display up
to CES day one,
laying it on the pillow and just laying there, or connecting it to the TV in the room. We'll see.
You own more like mobile HDMI cables than any other human being I know.
Dongles, man.
Dongles.
Dongles out the wazoo.
Oh, my goodness. Speaking of dongles out the wazoo, as I strive to continue the day of really awkward transitions, segues, we were talking about speakers. And one of the things we were talking about recently in speakers was those Vandersteins and the idea that they have time phase aligned drivers. And
this is where you ran.
They call it time and phase correct. But
we were talking about this in relation to like bi-wiring versus bi-amping, I think. And this is where you run separate lines to each of the drivers on this set of speakers.
Well.
And independent connections.
Yes and no.
And I thought at first, when we were talking about this initially, I was thinking it was a power thing, but it's the timing issue.
Well, there's a lot of things. Let's kind of work it backwards from the front of the speaker, right? If you go up to Vandersteen's website or Green Mountain Audio, and I'm pretty sure Teal and Focal, to one degree or another, they talk about the idea that their speakers are like, you know, time phase coherent or time phase correct or time phase aligned. There's a bunch of different expressions, but it also basically means is that
trying to get the sound waves from multiple sources to
arrive
like, at
a
point.
Exactly. The point being like the center.
Relatively controlled.
Imagine a line running from the center of your skull to basically the acoustic center of the tweeter, the acoustic center of the mid-range driver, the acoustic center of the woofer. And you might say to me, Patrick, why do I care? I'm glad you asked. Because, you know, because one of the things people like, well, they stagger or stage the drivers. For example, in those vast Vandersteins, there's the woofer, and then a few inches behind that and above it in a separate enclosure is like the mid driver, and then above and kind of behind that is the tweeter. And they do that not because, well, you got to put the tweeter in the back because high frequencies travel faster. No, you have to put the tweeter in the back because the acoustical center of a subwoofer or a woofer that's 6 inches deep is farther back than the acoustical center of a tweeter that's a half inch deep. So the idea is that they are going from the last nth of degree of performance out of the speaker by staging or, you know, lining up, you know, generally it's the woofer and then behind that is the mid-range, behind that is the tweeter, with the idea that the audio signal, when it leaves all three of those speakers, is going to arrive at that mythical spot in the center of your skull at the
very
same
cool
time.
I like that.
I like that idea. And the idea is that
if you the thoughtfulness
yeah,
of design.
Well, it's funny because it's, you know, I like saying it's funny, but it, the idea though it's is that, you know, you will actually have the signals, you know, the
waves.
You, the waves. Boy, I got way deeper into physics. There's a Robert, I think,
I
was
love physics.
Laughing. I could
no,
hear
no.
him all the way down in San Lorenzo.
Well,
I had like 23 links that I was putting in here, like everything from, like, I want to say Princeton EDU's acoustics and like no, it's yeah, let's see. We've got like the guy, okay, so Vandersteen's FAQ on time phase alignment. Mini DSP has a great discussion of time alignment. And then
cool.
There's
these
this
are
whole,
all product companies you respect, and they have
yeah.
actually good information online. And
then there
that,
was a,
that
a,
I love.
A crazy side loop I ran around looking at, because I started thinking, like, how much, because when you're talking about this, you know, sound moves really, really fast, about a foot a millisecond, give or
okay.
take. So, you know, if you are playing an electric guitar, one example was
through
put
air.
Out. Yeah, well, if you're playing an electric guitar and your amp is 12 feet away from you, then in theory, you know, you strum and 12 milliseconds later, plus whatever processing you're doing, right, you know, or whatever processing you're doing, then it comes out the speaker, and 12 milliseconds after it leaves the speaker, it comes to your head. And you start looking around, and when you look at broadcast specs, you know, audio should lead video by no more than 15 milliseconds. Audio should lag video by no more than 45 milliseconds. In film, like, the acceptable limp sync is about 22 milliseconds. And then
it's,
you get into
that
the people part's
that
are
interesting.
Yeah,
they're related to TV studies in particular. Mm-hmm. It's like if you hear the sound before the lips move, it's way more distracting than if it's delayed afterwards.
Yeah.
And or I have that completely backwards. But it's one. I think the way you just described it, because there was a millisecond difference between if the sound was leading or trailing. And believe me, when it came down to getting lip sync corrected on TVs and the studies that were done related to that in terms of what was the most offensive and how to deal with it and how to yeah. get it timed up. And thank God that's not as much of a issue nowadays with – at least in home theater with HDMI and
right.
lip sync correction functions that are built in. But when it comes to designing a beautiful speaker.
Yeah. Or a beautiful sounding speaker.
Yeah.
Because I've seen some beautiful sounding speakers that are just ugly as sin.
And then to be able to modify how it sounds by the positioning of the drivers.
Right.
And then you could think about all the work that went into that in terms
yeah.
of just modeling.
Because it's like time alignment, basically, that they arrive at the same time, X number of milliseconds. And then the phase alignment is that the idea that the wave of a particular frequency arrives, you know, at the same cycle of the phase. So, you know, 90 degrees, wherever it is in that phase. Because when you start getting into the physics of acoustics, you know, it's pretty crazy because I speak and that excites the air molecules in front of me, which excite the next layer of air molecules, which excite the next layer of air molecules. And
the waves emit.
The waves emit. And so for some speaker designers, they're sort of pursuing the nth level or the nth degree of accuracy is to make sure that all of the sound reaches your ear at the same time from all of the speakers, and that, you know, ideally it is all phase aligned or the wave, because crossovers, right? Boy, I don't want to start talking about crossovers or I'll put us both to sleep. There's also a really nice, you know, time alignment discussion up on mini DSPs. You know, and it's funny, but, you know, the time alignment's basically about making sure the sound from the, you know, all of the drivers and the speaker reaches your ear at the same time.
And this goes back to Vandersteen, and they're not using integrated electronics to perform this. They're actually doing it through the physical design
yeah.
of the speaker.
And in some cases, they do it
through... That's kind of a cool purity thing, too,
yes.
where it's like, if you pull that off, that's just a neat engineering
Well, we'll
feat.
Talk about purity later on. There are crossovers inside
the wrong
of there.
Word to use.
Well, no, but it's a good word because it's a loaded word, especially in audio.
Very loaded.
In any case, you can get deep into the mayhem of you know, crossovers and active crossovers and, you know, physical alignment of the drivers, you know, by where they're located in the case and all sorts of craziness. But the basic idea is that all the sound from all the different drivers gets to your ear at the same time. So that's when you're looking at a $50,000 pair of speakers and the drivers are all in, like, separate boxes that are angled at different degrees. Like, you know, Folk Hall for the Utopia 3, which is a giant speaker, it's much taller than I am, I guess they give you a lever so you can actually tune all of the different, because it's these boxes are kind of on a framework that they can actually manipulate the angle of the driver to perfect it, you know, when they're tuning it for your room.
Oh, beautiful.
But I sort of realized, like, a lot of speakers I've seen, you know, are doing some kind of for folk hall, they call it focus time function, when they're tweaking that. In any case, we'll put some links up in the show notes.
That's pretty sweet, though.
But it's not because, you know, bass frequencies travel faster than treble frequencies. It's because the sound comes from, you know, the woofer, the audio comes from, you know, a deeper spot in the speaker than the
dealing
tweeter.
With the waveforms emanating from different spots in space and in essence time, and then just the physical design to get that all to align and to sound good. I imagine maybe the perfect alignment isn't ideal. There's enough variability in terms of the internals in the case, and I'm just throwing it out there. I need to go read your links. I will pursue our show notes.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, and I'll figure out a better way to explain the phase alignment part of it. But the idea is that all of the music,
I get it.
All of the music should behave in the same way it does if you were sitting in the room with your musicians.
Yes.
Not that there are actual musicians sitting in the room at the same time in a lot of recordings, but that's a whole other weird conversation.
In a sense, if you think of the different members of a band as like the woofer, the mid, and the tweeter, and get those to play well together. And to do it without an excessive amount of DSP magic and things like that. So,
well, you know, there are places where DSP magic is appropriate.
Purity!
We have a letter about that. But first, let's read this letter from Christian, who writes, Christian basically wants to know what that white cloud is on his LCD. He says, I have a Samsung UN65KU 6500F that is only 4 months old. Since day one, I have noticed when the lower right part of the screen is black, I notice a lighter area of the screen that doesn't get black. I would call that, me, Patrick speaking, a cloud or a bloom. He's included a picture in the email he sent to us. When the area has colors in it, the picture looks amazing. You see no sign of the issue. Since I watch a lot of sci-fi and horror, I notice this issue a lot, and it's driving me crazy because basically you have a gray spot. Your beautiful black field of stars under UHD TV and that white cloud that is not supposed to be there in the corner. Had a Samsung rep to the house to look at it. He saw the issue and called it backlight leak. He said that replacing the panel should fix it. It didn't, and he doesn't seem to know what it could be. I said it was maybe the main board, because that seems the panel and the board are the main parts of the TV, and he said he would order the part and try that. Not going to fix it. No. Have you guys seen this before, and any suggestions what to say when I'm talking to the service rep in Samsung? P.S. I've tried every picture adjustment I could and even bought one of the Blu-ray calibration discs to try and fix it. Also confirmed it's not a reflection from something in the room. Thanks so much for the show, and have a nice weekend, Christian. And thank you, Christian. You have the shortest answer, most likely answer. The Occam's razor answer to this is...
It's a defect, right? And there isn't much you can really do about it. And the fact that he's seen this on two separate, distinct, different units in the same series indicates it was probably related to manufacturing. Or if this all came from the same shop in the same shipment, maybe something happened to that shipment. But overall,
the container was dropped.
When on an LCD system, and it is indeed backlight bleeding, the seal around the edge of the screen was either torqued or either through when it was during transport or setup. Unlikely setup. If you've now seen two of these devices in a row and they're both very similar.
That's what got it for me, because I've seen this caused by poorly located bolts for stands that manage to torque the enclosure and damage the LCD.
I've also seen people on wall mounts where, especially articulated mounts, and they'll grab one edge of the screen and the thing is locked down, and they'll start flexing that edge of it, and that will help distort and break that seal around the edge. Not break it, but it will flex it enough to where it can cause it to loosen up, say, or to create a gap to allow some light to come through. Enough to cause a glare where it's
running
not
into,
sealed the way it
having
should be.
A child or a drunken adult run into your television will do it. Having someone throw a ball into your television will do it.
And the only trick I've come across that can help alleviate this issue is simply taking a very clean microfiber cloth. Let the TV run it in vivid mode. Let it get as warm as it can. Run it for like an hour. And then gently wipe down the screen in like a circular pattern. Around the edges.
Yeah.
And it gives it a chance to help reseal those edges. And it, it may move the problem,
right.
But it may also as likely help minimize it.
Sometimes you can basically massage the spot down towards the edge.
Do not press hard. Do not use a – I hate to even touch a brand new screen because any contact on it is just potential for marring that anti-reflective coating or other issue. So just be super gentle about it and maybe focus just on that one spot. Like he noticed too, you really only see it in dark scenes or letterboxed movies.
It's maddening.
When the whole screen's lit up with 16:9 content, you never notice this stuff. And this is another reason people love OLED so much. When you have a per pixel illumination system where, you know, there is no light being pushed through the panel that has to be perfectly sealed around the edges. Each pixel's illuminating emitting its own light. And so there is no adjustment in the picture settings to correct this. Avoid letterbox content.
I would say see if you can return it and get another model Samsung or a competitive television, because quite frankly, if it's happened with two of these in a row...
If the rag fix doesn't take care of it and it's going to distract you to no end in your primary viewing times, maybe in the middle of the night, maybe you watch TV all the time and you're going to be in that darkroom environment and you're always going to see it if you can't correct it, then take advantage of the return policy and... and choose again, unfortunately. I hate to say that, but...
Or but try buying them from a different source.
But try the rag. Yeah. Or try the microfiber, the beautifully clean microfiber cloth. Hopefully it's brand spanking new.
If you can't return it, feel free to push it really hard, especially if you have a credit card damage.
But otherwise, my first check. I've seen, I want to say, at trade shows, I watched the Sharp crew disassemble a set. And actually put it back together to address that issue on one of the trade show displays. But that was a team of engineers working on that thing. And ain't no way I'm going to recommend you go flip that thing onto its back
Do
and
not
start unscrewing every.
I love you, iFixit. You are my friends. I believe in your mission. Very few people are qualified. And for me to say this, I'll open up anything and try to fix it. There's just about nothing, you know, except for like capacitor replacements.
Oh, please.
You know, anything involving the actual physical screen on a flat panel is just a nightmare to repair.
After my trip to China, I will say there were people just on the sidewalk disassembling TVs on tables.
I am not one of them.
It's not that there aren't that many parts in there. But,
true.
So... I love iFixit. That's all. I suddenly am thinking about how many times I've used that service to repair electronics.
iFixit has sponsored me on many shows I've been on. They have not sponsored me on this show, but iFixit.com is awesome if you want to fix things. And given how many phones they've helped me save, thank you, iFixit. We got a lovely email from Mike regarding my growing obsession with the Wii Mini DSP digital audio signal processors. He sent this in to ask@avxl.com, and you can send an email to ask@avxl.com, even if you're not a patron at patreon.com/avxl. But if you're not a patron at patreon.com/avxl, you should be, because it'll help make it possible for us to do the show. It's like a tip jar for Robert and I. In any case.
Yeah.
In any case, Mike writes in, Patrick, I think you may be confusing what most audiophiles traditionally refer to as a DSP and what Siegfried is doing with the Mini DSP. Mr. Linkwitz is using the Mini DSP as an active crossover in his speaker designs. This active crossover simply takes the place of the passive crossover you see inside most unpowered speakers. Active crossovers are actually considered superior to passive crossovers even in the audiophile world. In pro audio, they are used almost exclusively. When you say that you, like most audiophiles, have an aversion to digital signal processing in the precious audio path, I'm assuming what you're referring to is equalization through DSP, Dirac, Odyssey, ARC, or ARC, etc. This is not the same as DSP-driven active crossovers. Mr. Linkwitz himself has expressed his own distaste for DSP room equalization, and he is even against extensive room treatments due to the semi-omnidirectional nature of his loudspeaker designs and its dependence on room reflections for lifelike sound. By the way, I've heard them. They are amazing. I will be building a set of Mr. Linkwitz's speakers. In short, active crossovers are not the same evil as room EQ. All subwoofers, receivers, and pre-pros employ active crossovers through DSP. Unless your setup is strictly a tubes and vinyl all-analog type kit, DSP is virtually inescapable. Anyway, apples and oranges. I know I'm being picky, but people tune in for advice, so, you know, have a great day, man. Mike.
That's awesome.
That was an awesome letter. Dude, I love picking nits. I can spend hours moving a speaker an inch at a time until zing, the whole image comes together. Robert's watched me do this. I've watched Robert calibrate televisions.
Yeah.
You know, I am actually on all sides of this. I hated DSP audio processing room enhancements from the early days of computers. Spatializers were the ones I was thinking of. And I actually managed to keep my signal path shockingly analog for years as a result, excepting, of course, that everything I was listening to was sourced from a digital source. Therefore, there was a digital analog converter, which probably contained DSPs for audio decoding and processing. In any case, you are correct, and I definitely want to make it clear, Mr. Linkwitz, who I've eaten brownies with after listening to his frickin' awesome speakers, uses the mini DSP as an active crossover, not to do foo-rah, like try to make your speakers sound like they're in Radio City Music Hall, perhaps the single most disappointing DSP setting of all time, because I have seen...
I still don't understand why those are in AVRs. They're all horrible sounding.
Some engineer somewhere who's very, very senior... just keeps shoving those in there.
I don't think it's even up to him anymore. It's just like, it's been there. Yeah. Leave it there. But
for me, and, you know, Mike, you know, realizing that this extraordinarily talented engineer, Mr. Linkwitz, was using digital signal processing because, you know, he couldn't design. He built hardwired, you know, crossovers, and he did them through mini DSP. And, you know, you can do a lot more faster and experiment more with a digital or an active crossover. So, you know, it was a wake-up call for me that digital signal processing is not necessarily evil. And seriously, thank you for writing in. That was a lovely letter.
Excellent.
We are going to get going in a couple minutes, but after we stop talking to each other, we're going to have the interview that I did down at CanJam LA with Jason Lord from the Source AV Design Group, Torrance, California, who, amongst other things... has been educated at MIT on the audios.
I am looking forward to this.
It's good stuff. Room tuning and talking about the three primaries, reflection, diffusion, and absorption, and how those positively or negatively impact your sound, and why, ladies and gentlemen, you probably want cotton or wool curtains. I'll let you listen to that in a couple minutes. What we're watching this week, I am still fascinated by The Get Down on Netflix, American Gods, which I'm watching on Stars via Amazon Prime, hence my excitement about Amazon Prime being on the Apple TV finally. Ian McShane is awesome. If you've never seen Deadwood, Al Swearengen, played by Ian McShane in Deadwood, is one of the great characters of all time. Ricky Whittle doing a great job as Shadow Moon. If you haven't read American Gods by Neil Gaiman, it is a fantastic book.
Cool.
And oddly enough, given that every television series I've liked in the past 2 years has immediately been canceled, you know, and we're only a couple episodes into American Gods, so it may suck before the end of the season. But it has been renewed for a second season, which brings me a serious amount of joy.
That is awesome.
Oh, my goodness. And you're looking for a Formula One in 4K.
I am trying, and I look it up online. This weekend is the Spain race, so currently I'm streaming it through NBC Sports Network's app, which works pretty well. Goes right to the Chromecast, lets you, on race day, they'll sometimes do a quad view, which shows a real-time map with live driver views and other stuff like that. That's pretty neat. But if I could watch it any way in the world, I might have to move over to Europe, sign up for Sky Sports, and with that Sky Q subscription and the 2 terabyte Sky Q box, with all of that aligned, you can then stream most of the season, apparently, in 4K, which would be epic. And I really, I think that is a sport that would look pretty damn fantastic. Not only in just the resolution, but I think also for the color. Mm-hmm. It's like nobody's seen Ferrari red on a TV until just recently with this new, you know.
Having seen Ferrari red in Las Vegas and Ferrari red on a television,
in
HD television, I will agree.
There are dramatic color differences, and that's just one aspect of it, but that's just... The more content we can get streaming in 4K, especially live events, that's something we really just don't have a lot of right now. And that'll be the next thing I'm interested to see how, where, and why. I will say, though, if you're a DirecTV subscriber, the pain and the love, they are pushing more 4K content than I think anyone else here, at least in the U.S.
Right.
So for things like...
Does it stream well from the big satellite in the sky?
That's what I'm curious. I have heard no complaints from the DirecTV 4K customers that I've talked to. Everyone's just like, you know, it works. It looks really good. And there are other companies pushing it too. New Line, we've talked about before. They had exclusive partnerships with Sony televisions in particular. Mm-hmm. And that will be expanding. And they were doing a lot of UFC fight coverage in 4K 60 with their technology. And I am just hoping that more people, more of the broadcasters will adopt something like that and make it an option on their streaming offerings. Because I don't see 4K broadcasting outside of satellite coming anytime soon, at least live programming. So to be able to do that through an app is probably the next easiest thing.
Oh, yeah, my goodness.
Looking forward to it.
If you haven't seen the latest trailer for Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk, the movie, go check it out. It's
will
all
do.
Over the internet. You've
will
probably seen it already. I am unbelievably looking forward to that movie. And if you've never seen Inception on Blu-ray, it is fantastic.
Have.
You haven't seen it? I will loan it to you.
I have it, I'm sure.
It's a good movie.
I have a lot of Blu-rays in the collection that I have yet to watch. So,
in which case, you do not need the new director's definitive edition of Heat, which has been remastered. And,
okay.
Better video than the last Blu-ray release of it. So, I don't know. I keep wanting that movie to be better than I think it is. But, you know, there's that scene with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. And boy, they're chewing up a lot of scenery.
I just watched a YouTube video about the 25th anniversary of Reservoir Dogs to see how it holds up. And does it hold up? And
yes.
It holds up remarkably well. It's one of his earliest movies for Quentin Tarantino, and it has some of those, you know, early works quirks about it, you could say. However, that's one movie, if you haven't thought about in a while, watch it again.
It's funny you mention that, because I realized last night I was talking to my wife, we want to watch Pulp. We haven't watched Pulp Fiction in forever.
Another good one, man. That's family entertainment right there.
With that, ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned. We've got Jason Lord coming up to talk about how to make your speakers sound better, because it's not just the speakers, it's the room they're in, and you don't necessarily have to spend millions to do it. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
And you can find us next week on AVXL.com. And if you're feeling generous, patreon.com/AVXL. We'd appreciate the help. So a few weeks ago, I told you about this amazing space in Torrance, California, the Source AV Design Group. I was down there to listen to electric static headphones, and we talked about that. And one of the most amazing things about the Source AV Design Group is they have these six incredible home theater demo rooms from the kid's gone to college, we're going to turn his bedroom into something amazing, up to this $1.3 million flagship experience with these incredible Macintosh transmission line speakers, like double JL audio subwoofers, just an absolute ass-kicking amazing space to listen to music to or have a home theater experience. And a big part of that is Jason Lord, the founder of the Source AV Design Group, who, and you know, first of all, Jason, welcome. Wanted to get him on the Welcome to AVXL. You've had kind of a mythical Southern California, you know, surfer. Ends up you like interned at Motown, basically.
Right.
You know, and then you go to study acoustics at MIT, your audio engineering at MIT.
After Vietnam, right.
And you know, eventually you find yourself designing home theaters, amazing home theaters.
Well, the choice there was be retired and follow the honey-do list every day that my wife would give me or do something fun. Home theater seemed like an appropriate thing.
Home theater is a fun thing. And one of the things that was amazing for me walking into that flagship room, and actually pretty much all the rooms you have set up there, you know, is I walk into the room and I'm like, this, you know, and I start clapping my hands and you got this look on your face, you know, like, you know, Northern California nerd boy's actually been in a room before. And it is... You know, it's set up like a really well set up recording studio. It's not dead. It's not, you know, it's not a big hard surface that reflects everything. It is a really sweet room for playing back audio. That's a lot of engineering on your part.
You know, it's it probably is in terms of time on the job and learning how to actually control certain things. But if we understand that in any environment we have certain assets that the room can provide because it's part of the speaker presentation, and certain deficits. The primary deficit, the part that makes it uncomfortable for your brain and your ears, is what we refer to as a confused image, which means that we have too much reflection and the net is the presentation is no longer clear to our brain, and we have to then process that like a DSP would and clear those things up for our brain, and our brain's working too hard. So the joy of that, whether it be a theater presentation or an audio presentation from the standpoint of just playing music, gets damaged because our brain's working too hard. But when our brain is relaxed and able to hear things correctly and cohesively, our brain loves music. It is part of fundamentally who we are as a human.
So when I think of places I've seen, places I spent a lot of hours of my youth listening to music, two of my favorite venues have some of the worst acoustics, I think, in the history of the planet. The Continental in Lower Manhattan, Maxwell's in Hoboken, New Jersey. They were basically cinder block rooms. Paint on cinder block. And if you had enough people crowded around the stage, it wasn't too bad. But if it was kind of an empty night, all of the audio just sort of bounced. You had to either be right next to the band, or everything was just like all of the reflections just muddying everything up.
Right.
I mean, is essentially controlling the reflected audio, is that the heart of making a room sound its best?
Typically, yes. Especially if you're a music lover.
Uh-huh.
You know, in a theater application, when James Bond blows something up and it fires out of four different, out of your seven speakers, you've got four different speakers firing, it's a confused image, but it's part of the sound field. When you're listening to two-channel audio, or, well, specifically two-channel audio, that bouncing around creates trauma. Your brain has this thing that it can't process real quick. If you can correct or mitigate a portion of that, not taking it away entirely because it is music and it is how music comes across, but mitigate some of the extra, you actually come up with a sound field that now your ears can very comfortably understand, and your brain starts to imagine how, where that bass player is, where that drummer is. Music placement becomes obvious, and then of course depth of field and sound stage become very much more obvious, and then you end up with a pleasant listening experience. And so cohesively your brain is actually able to understand everything that's going on.
It's so funny because you're trying to recreate the confusion from the original recording or the engineering and mastering, not the additional stuff that's layered on by putting that room's sound into your room.
Right. And the only time you would have any of that extra, we'll call it ambient noise or reflection, is really only happens in live formats, and we have ways in live performances to mitigate it through gating and different microphone issues and our devices. And so in live performance to record, we can actually create a much closer to studio control. But in a studio, it's a dead world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the idea is more anechoic, and that way they can then take what's coming from that input or that microphone and put it onto tape or hard drive. And again, they've captured the essence directly from the device, so they no longer have to worry about controlling what happens as a reflection.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're going to put it through a speaker, and we're going to put it in your living room. And when that happens, you might have glass windows, you might have Venetian plaster, you might have, you know, travertine tile floors, you might have hardwood floors. There's all these really hard surfaces that will reintroduce that confused image.
And not necessarily in a good way.
Well, typically not, yes.
So should I, like, carpet the entire interior of the room and put, like, lead-filled sound-deadening foam so I create a completely inert place where the sound stops as soon as it hits a wall?
It's a little garage bandish, but you might as well staple some eggshell cartons to your walls at the same time. No, there are actual math formulas that you can use. So in acoustics, we have three primary properties, right? We have reflection, diffusion, right? And these are two of the most normal. We also have reflex. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I ever say reflection?
Reflection, diffusion.
Yeah. And so these are the two primary. So reflection is primarily control. Diffusion has to do with more about laying out size. Mm-hmm. And so these are the two that really make the most difference. So if we can take... people should pay attention to the surfaces in their room. So the number one least complimentary reflection is off your floor.
Mm-hmm.
If you can kill that one directly, mm-hmm. now you only have border issues. And border issues are the outside areas of the speaker firing platform. So on your left speaker, it's far left, there's a wall, and it's reflecting off of that. Depending on how it's reflecting, you may need to control it to a degree or moderate it to a degree. Same thing with the right side. If it's a brick or if it's glass.
Right. I've had both. I've had both in the same room.
You got to control those things. But you never want to kill the audio, because if you take the life out of it, you're basically just creating what happens in an anechoic chamber.
Which sounds wrong.
It does sound incorrect.
So I don't think a lot of people realize, right, the sound comes out of the speaker. Mm-hmm. If you've aimed the speaker correctly, it's kind of coming at your head, or you know, if you're running like maybe a set of Tecton mini lures, it's coming, you know, it's crossing over behind your head. But the point is the sound comes from the speaker and you're looking at the speaker, but the sound is also radiating out from the speaker and then bouncing, reflecting off the floor, and that's creating. So let's say it's a hi-hat. You know, I hit a hi-hat, right. Whack. Yeah. So the hi-hat's coming at me. And then the hi-hat's coming off, bouncing off the floor and coming at me. And it's also bouncing off the wall and coming at me. Those are the first order reflections.
Yeah, but they're all hitting you at separate times.
That's
hence
a problem.
Hence the confused image, right?
Right.
So, mitigating. So, absorption mm-hmm. is another one of the three characteristics. So, we do that on the floor because we don't want that reflection coming from the floor. Mm-hmm. Because it hits us before the border reflections do. And the border reflections are a little bit more natural than the floor reflection. So if we can, you know, you got a pair of speakers in your living room, you listen to music, and it is whatever style it is, it doesn't really matter what style it is. What right. matters is that we don't want the same music hitting our ears three different times. So it's time alignment is really what we're talking about, is how do we put that into perspective through either one of those three properties. Right?
Right.
Deflection, diffusion, or absorption.
My favorite room hack, having spent a lot of time in tiny apartments in North Jersey.
Right.
Get a rug down on the floor. Right. Like put a mirror on the floor. Figure out your seating position. You move the mirror until you can kind of see the speakers in the mirror. And then, God help you if you have spousal approval issues, but you get a rug down on the floor so the rug blocks that reflection from right. hitting the floor. There's not much else you can do with a floor, is there? I mean, you could change the surface.
Well, you do.
you tear the wood floor out.
You could turn it into your first lawn in your living room. Okay, so like I said, that always tends to be the worst of the different issues that occur. And it's kind of because it's not on a linear plane with your ear, mm-hmm. because it's going to hit the floor, and then what does it do? On an angle, it goes back up to the ceiling, and then it goes into another reflection point, right? And so now it's coming down from the ceiling. And these are all different timing. Mm-hmm. The more of that we add, the more of a confused image we have. So it is, let's take what is unnatural out, leave what is natural in, and enhance or trap what we need to, if the room reactance happens. Mm-hmm. So there's bass traps. Bass traps are typically designed to help control hot spots mm-hmm. in bass.
Let's hold up. Before we get into bass traps, talk to me about, like, I have a subwoofer. Uh-huh. I position the subwoofer like I do the subwoofer crawl or I do math. Hmm. You know, the whole point of positioning a subwoofer is trying to eliminate standing waves.
Right.
What's a standing wave?
It's where you stand up in your chair and you wave.
I knew that was coming.
So a standing wave is the first order of how to get a reactance off of a room. Mm-hmm. So it can be a negative. If that standing wave is too hot and it reacts to a wall, so for example, that wall becomes sort of an amplifier to that. And now we have, again, a timing issue. Mm-hmm. And we have too much of what that grouping of frequencies is reacting to.
Is it kind of like a subwoofer where let's say a tuned port subwoofer where it's like A, B, C, D, G, yeah. Like where like it's one notey where there's that.
I used to have a bass guitar in the 60s that had that one spot that would give me that note, it would just pop out. But it's, so yes, it is room reactant. So if you were starting a room from square one, mm-hmm. of course, the more rigidity we have, the better off we are. So you can start there. If you're dealing with an existing room and, you know, maybe the property or the building itself wasn't built all that well, mm-hmm. And they didn't put any blocking into the walls and, mm-hmm. and didn't do anything to reinforce it, then it's very likely at certain gain levels, certain frequencies will cause that wall to react, mm-hmm. creating a standing wave that it can be ugly.
Okay.
And of course, we don't want that. a lot of people don't recognize these things because they don't really understand the math, but they can recognize it when their ear goes, I don't understand why this doesn't sound right. Sometimes it's just the synergy of the system. Mm-hmm. Most often, they've picked something that they heard in a store or wherever they got it from and they liked it. They got it home, and now they didn't realize that the home or the environment it lives in is part of the speaker presentation.
Right.
But it doesn't mean you have to take every one of your walls and put 8-pound fiberglass on with a piece of fabric over it to suck up the high frequencies to help do that. And oftentimes you can diffuse things mm-hmm. and ease them up. And in some cases, you if the room's too live, you have to take and do a little absorption. But you don't ever want to get to a point where you're just sucking the high frequency out because you kill it.
So in terms of like a simple diffusion, you know, putting a wall of books up mm-hmm. where the spines don't all stick out at the same frequency, putting curtains in front of the plate glass window or having curtains, you can, you know, my classic, like the worst possible environment for a home theater is the corner apartment of a Miami apartment building with the big glass walls, because you have these horrible reflective walls, you have all this sunshine, you're fighting it to create some place where you can actually watch your movie.
You have to discern which one's more important, that beautiful view of the beach.
Yeah. So curtains are nice because you can pull the curtains out. I mean, you know, is some non-gauzy, fairly heavy curtains, is that enough to diffuse the reflection off of the window?
It can be, depending on how it's initiated. So if it's a plastic-based product, it's not going to have the significance that a woolen or a cotton-based product would have. And a lot of fabrics are made from plastics now.
Right.
As long as you're paying attention to what that fabric is made out of, then you could be, in fact, capturing certain things. If it's a woolen or cotton-based product, that sound can go right through that thing. But it's now, as it traveled through, it slowed down enough where as it's in behind that hard surface and that same fabric, it'll bounce back and forth and almost be captured. So it does, in fact, work. You have to be very careful of how you do that if you're looking for perfection. But it is one way to solve a portion of that problem.
We like perfection on AVXL, but mostly we're looking for things to suck a lot less than they do.
So as long as we're paying attention, mm-hmm. you don't have to know the math.
Right.
It would be good if people really understand the practical application of acoustic control. And I don't find that a lot of stereo stores mm-hmm. understand that. But that doesn't mean that there aren't any. And there are a number of guys that are really, really good in the hi-fi business that are, they understand the properties, they understand how to control things. And then it becomes, how do we introduce that to the consumer? Because the consumer doesn't recognize the science afterwards, mm-hmm. you know, the science of the room itself.
Right.
When you try and explain it to them, it's almost like they think you're probably trying to sell them a bill of goods or something, but... So the Source AV, you talk about the rooms, right? And how you can walk in there and clap and the room's not dead. Because we don't hire salespeople, you have to be an engineer or an installer to work at the Source. The example, letting them walk into those rooms like you did and letting them hear from the hallway as they enter and then say, hey, pay attention to your voice right now. And as you walk in that door, notice a change. They instantly hear that control.
Right.
And now they can understand the application. And then it's just a matter of taking and exploring the room that they want to put it into, making mm-hmm. sure that you're approaching it correctly, and you're done.
So I've seen you, you know, we were talking at one point down there where, you know, you guys had, you know, run the wires, built the stiff walls, put the treatment on, had the finished carpenter in. And in other cases, you know, some of the smaller rooms, you've got like maybe one piece of, you know, art on the wall that happens to be fabric and probably has a whole bunch of fiberglass filler behind it. You know, if somebody's at home, like, you know, there's a lot of places that sell like prepackaged kits for doing your acoustics. And mm-hmm. and one end there's like RLX where they're like, they're trying to engineer this stuff for, I am a home audio engineer. I can send in the specs of my room. They can tell you where to put the stuff. And at the other end, there's places like, you know, I will affectionately call it Bob's House of Insulation in a Box. And they tell you to basically take this square of insulation, or there's, you know, online instructions where it's going to, you're going to take mineral wool and you're going to put it in a, you know, you're going to build a frame, put your mineral wool cutaways in there, glue the fabric over it. How do you know, like, what frequencies you're damping, or is it effective, or you know, because a lot of people, they can't afford to have an engineer come in and go, like, set up the equipment and do the tuning. What's the happy medium there?
Well, so what happens when you're doing the cookie cutter acoustics? So you're right. building a home theater.
Right.
And you got XYZ company who's selling you these fiberglass panels and says, okay, we've created this design. Here's how it looks. What that company hasn't done is measured the reactants in your room in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And so what they're doing is they're providing a consistent product that basically does the same thing every time.
Which is good.
Yes.
But not every room is the same.
Well, yeah, there's that. But there's but there's also speaker placement. Mm-hmm. There's also listening styles. And these things, as they're considered, are important. And the consumer has an expectation. They may not know how to express that, but they right. have an expectation. The challenge with the cookie cutter formats is that they typically use a heavy pound fiberglass. Mm-hmm. And sometimes to the point where they might actually be absorbing all the necessary frequencies to be able to gather coherence in the music or movie.
So one thing is like that kind of blew my mind was realizing like you don't have to cover the entire wall to absorb all the frequencies.
No, oftentimes you don't deliberately because right. you would like a degree of surface to be able to help enhance that high frequency mm-hmm. when you've taken the hard reflection points out where right. the points are actually creating so much confusion that you need to control it. But what happens to either side of that may be what you need right. to keep that sound correct.
So like 4 square feet at the first point of reflection to the right or left of the speaker.
That's actually a good formula. Four square feet, depending on the size of the right. room overall, should cover most of the confused image.
Right. You know.
But you don't want to suck it up. You want to make sure that you're still allowing it to breathe.
In terms of high frequencies, like, you know, when you're looking at it, how the heavier the insulation is, the more of the acoustic signal it's going to absorb, or the broader the range of frequencies?
Well, okay, so depending on how it's compressed or put together, like uh-huh. here's a really good example. There's a product that is known as furniture batting. Mm-hmm. It's a real soft, cottony kind of silk. You know, it's plastic.
I've helped rebuild a couch.
Okay.
I know it intimately.
Very loosely done.
Yeah.
Right. So interior decorators, interior designers, the guys who don't know anything about acoustics, they go into your new house and they go, oh, I can do this really beautiful silk wall and it's special silk from India and it came from a special worm who got pregnant 3 times.
You're so LA right
now. and then they put the batting in behind it to get the tufted feel or whatever right. they want to do. What they've just done is eliminated 80% of your high frequency because it is so loosely wrapped that all that high frequency just goes in behind that silk, what can be captured behind it, right? Mm-hmm. But that silk has a sheen to it, so it's kicking back too much reflection while part of it's being captured, and it's completely the worst possible thing you could do, but it's cheap.
Right.
So you go down to Joann's, you buy the furniture batting, you see your fabrics. Oh, this is beautiful. The one thing on fabrics you want to try and stay away from is anything that has a sheen.
So a hard, you don't want what we call a hard fabric.
Okay, we'll call it that.
I spent a bunch of time with furniture and suits. It's like the only thing I know about fabric. This is a hard hand.
So you travel. Well, look at the chairs in this hotel. I mean, we're on. This is like a vinyl, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you put vinyl on your wall, will it react differently than a painted wall? Probably not.
Funny.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's kind of there's a challenge. So we want a degree of absorption. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a critical thing. But we don't want to completely kill anything because why would we take the life out of what we're listening to?
No. I was talking to somebody yesterday and we're down here at Can Jam 2017 and somebody was like, you know, I like anechoic chambers. I'm like, I hate them. Like when I walk into an anechoic chamber, I think my head's about to collapse from the inside. You know, because there's no reflectivity. It's right. it's the mental version of me for being thrust into the cold, dark blackness of space. It's just wrong.
Yeah, there's just you're in over a big tunnel that's right directly below you.
Yeah,
and you're all those frequencies all are just dropping down. Right. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So there are anechoic chambers that are frequency sensitive. So you can go into anechoic chambers that basically just show you base asset and base deficits. And bass control is one of my expertise. That was the first thing I wanted to learn, was how to keep bass from damaging mid-range and high frequency.
Well, I kind of steered you. We were talking about standing waves in rooms, mm-hmm. and I asked you about that because of bass traps, which right. brings us kind of back to where I sidelined you, and we right. started talking about panels right. and stuff. You know, how do you tune for bass? Like, once you've identified, like, oh my goodness, I have a giant standing wave that's driving me insane.
I have this wall that's turning into a secondary speaker. I
hate it when that happens.
so you're either going to go into that wall and correct mm-hmm. it and make it more rigid so it's not going to have the reactance, or you're going to try and trap mm-hmm. into the hot spot of that wall or corner that it might be. Typically, it'll happen in a corner mm-hmm. more than a flat area, a flat long area. And so how do we make it so it basically just kills that hot spot mm-hmm. so that it remains consistent throughout the rest of the room? And that's what a trap is doing. A lot of people will over-trap, and some people will under-trap, but most of the cases they over-trap. When they over-trap, they find themselves with a deficit, and typically those deficits occur between 80 and 140 hertz. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty significant area. There's a lot of fundamental in that area.
So a whole lot of bass in the left side of the piano and tubas and
everything. Yeah. Or me on five string basses yeah. or acoustic basses. It's you don't want it to go away. You want right. it to be linear, and you want it to be appropriate. And you don't want the hollows. Mm-hmm. You can put hollows in deliberately. If I'm working with a customer and they say, you know, I'm a big cello fan, mm-hmm. right? I really love cello, so I need my mid bass to be really nice. But I hate bass extension, and I don't want to ever listen to a pipe organ. Okay. Mm-hmm. So how do you get rid of bass extension? Now that's the challenge. So if you have the bass extension, if it exists,
right.
getting rid of it is probably one of the most difficult things. People ask me, what happens with bass transfer? Well, you know, you have to be in a bunker to stop yeah. bass transfer. And that bunker wall of concrete has to be relatively consistent, because you can go outside of it. You know, back in the 70s, you know, it was like disco was everywhere and everybody was doing like they do now. It's in concerts where the kick drum and the bass end was mm-hmm. so heavy. And you could be in a room that was filled, you know, cinder block walls. It could be concrete filled.
I can acoustically isolate a room, and you will still feel everything under 30 hertz in that room, or 40 hertz or something.
So nothing short of a right. bunker really can stop those frequencies. So what do we do? If it's those extreme sub-frequencies, right. your only choice is to find a way to turn it down.
Okay.
Okay. In a practical sense, if you were able to build the room from the ground up, and if the room is not 100% perpendicular, mm-hmm. Then you can. It's easy to do. Mm-hmm. So, have you ever noticed you go into certain environments like a theater, movie theater, or you're going into a concert arena or a room that's dedicated for that? You'll almost notice that they're fan shaped.
Yeah.
Okay. That is to avoid those standing waves. And the structure has been done in a way where the hard wall mm-hmm. is consistent down from point to point. So it's got two corners on that hard wall. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be as consistent as they could have possibly made it from the back corner to the front corner. Mm-hmm. In doing that, that consistency helps us absolutely predict how our frequencies are going to happen in that room. So that's the real acoustic. So when we go build a Disney theater or mm-hmm. we go build an amphitheater of some kind somewhere, these things are basically formatted in the structure. Right. But we walk into a person's house.
Everything's square.
Did that custom builder consider that?
Right.
No. Did the homeowner consider that? No. Did the architect consider that? No.
I mean, I had this stunning realization, because I have the living room where I have is like, you know, there's a wall that runs all along the front side of the house, uh-huh. And then that's the right side of the living room. And the left side of the living room, the wall only runs two-thirds of the length of the room,
right.
which turns out to be absolutely fantastic. compared to just having a long rectangular, or worse yet, like the worst room possible is like a cube.
Square.
Yeah. You know, and then you know, things are better with a rectangle. The rectangle with the open wall, oddly enough, turns out to be helpful for not creating a bunch of standing waves. And
you
then
energy you release. That's what you want. Energy release is important. Yeah.
Can opening a door give you enough energy release?
It depends on where your sound stage is and that door is. Obviously, if that sound stage is on the same wall as that door,
right,
the energy release is too late.
Right.
If that energy release happens in the back wall from the listening stage, it's very likely it can be an asset. And if it's offset and it's not exactly symmetrical, it could be even better.
So thinking about bass traps again, like I've seen everything from like dense foam blocks to people shoving an ottoman in a corner. I mean, you know, can I create an ottoman out of dense foam blocks?
I was thinking about using my mother-in-law. Just see her stand in the corner.
Careful, this will be on the internet. I don't think she'll find it, but
she's in China. We're okay.
Nothing says I love you like the entire breadth of the Pacific Ocean. I mean, are the little foam blocks effective, or do you need to know like what the frequency you're trying to trap is first?
It would be best if you knew the frequencies that you're. If you can find a way to measure the frequencies that are causing the problem, identify them clearly, then you can actually buy the accoutrement that you need to make it happen. Because there are not every company who makes acoustic products is actually doing something worthwhile.
Right.
But there are companies that actually do these things as a real living, and they use math. They've used math in the process. And so, yes, if you can identify the frequency hotspots or deficits, you can correct easily.
So some people think that they're going to be able to digitally tune a room completely with a DSP, and they can get around all of the problems with standing waves and first-order reflections.
Nothing does that.
Okay.
So everything they're doing basically is an EQ.
Mm-hmm.
So they're identifying frequencies that are too abundant.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, because they're digital basically starts from a zero reference point and then cuts. Old analog stuff, you would boost above zero reference, right? And you would cut depending on the areas. But digital stuff is different. It basically uses zero as the cap. That's the hot spot.
Right.
And so you're basically cutting groups of frequencies, which essentially is eliminating the possibility of distortion. Because when you're boosting, you're probably going to create distortion.
Sure.
So the answer to that, I guess, kind of is DSP's EQ.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, they can actually help time align things, but they cannot get rid of reflection.
And reflection is what I need to
number one. That's the number one. That's the number one. That's we can call that public enemy number one. Reflection is public enemy number one.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Jason Lord, the Source AV Design Group, Torrance, California. How do people find the website if they want to learn more?
So that is thesourceav.com. And so, or there's the 800 number, I guess, is 800-700-7029. I have to remember my own phone number.
You probably don't call it that.
I don't call myself.
If you're in the LA area and you're looking to buy some very nice headphones, personal audio devices, headphone amps, the entire Focal speaker lineup.
Yes.
The place
Sonus Faber and a number of brands, yeah.
The place is Disney. Like you had a set of quad like ES4 electrostatics in there.
You know, we are one of the first guys who embraced the new quad company.
Uh-huh.
Very good company. Talk
about a mythical unicorn speaker.
Right.
Are they as good as people?
You know, the new stuff is actually surprisingly good because unlike the original quads back when I was a youngster and had stack quads, I used to love that sound. I would drive them with my MC275 Mac amplifiers and, you know, my audio research preamplifier, and it would be my Thorns turntable back in the day. It was great. But there was always that from 60 hertz down that didn't seem to exist.
Right.
The new quads embrace bass.
Really?
They can actually do it. And they can do it on a very linear basis. And so I'm kind of surprised how good they came back, better than what they were as a kid when I remember them. Of course, we're dealing with memory.
Yeah.
And I'm not at that age anymore where I can be certain that my memory is perfect. But
you know, there's enough written accounts of people gushing over quad electrostatics back in the day. And
I think they should hear the new ones because it embraces a lot of that wonderful sound, but it gives us the new addition of lower frequency extension.
I love me some bass.
Yeah. And they react really nicely to almost any room, so you're less likely to fight that speaker in a room than you would other speakers.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.